live. All right, Vishnu, what'd you think?
I thought that was great. It's a lot of fun to get somebody that's really deep into an industry to kind of just show you the ins and outs and kind of how they think. And Jesse has been in this sort of like tech plus biotech world for long enough that I think we really got that.
All right, well, let's tell people. We spoke with Jesse Johnson today, and he is, man, he's got a very colorful background. He is currently the VP of data science and data engineering at DuPoint Therapeutics. And we got into so much in this episode. He really called out a few gems for me. One was the life cycle of like tools and how a lot of people are working on the same problem at the same time when the maturity of these companies or these problems start to get into a certain sector or they start to get to a certain point. Then out of nowhere, someone says, you know what, let's spin off a company from this. So he mentioned data lakes. He mentioned, I think it was, what was the other one he mentioned? But I instantly thought, yeah, exactly. And I instantly thought about when we look at the MLOps space, it's like monitoring tools or feature stores, things like that, and how they're built internally at a company. And they're probably built at many companies simultaneously, but then somebody says, you know what, let's just make a product out of this, and they spin it out, and then you get to see how everything transpires. And really his wisdom is like, oh, so then you have all of these teams that have their homegrown solutions, and they go and they have to decide, do we want to switch to the managed service or not? So that was one of the gems that I absolutely loved. Also got to call out that he made an excellent point of metadata and data and how important those two are, not just the data, but also the metadata that goes with it, the frameworks. I mean, what did you like?
I think that metadata versus metadata point is really salient, because what that really speaks to is this idea of context versus, let's say, transactions, right? I mean, if you think about any kind of transactional data in a lab, it could be an experiment, right? Somebody dropping a few drops onto a plate. In a retail setting, it could be somebody buying something. There's certain data associated with that transaction. But oftentimes, there's a lot more context around who is actually engaging in that transaction or what kind of other elements influence the interpretation of that data. So and good. I think Jesse really gave a good overview of how they try to solve that problem in a realm where context is as crucial, if not more crucial, than any other industry. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much good stuff. He also talked about knowledge sharing and how to standardize processes. It's just enjoy the show. We're going to be having this coffee session. Let us know if you like this style of intro also, because it's something that Vishnu and I thought we should just try and do because we were so stoked on the actual conversation. The last thing I want to mention before we jump into the show or the session, the coffee session, grab your coffees or teas, whatever you like. We are trying to find people that would be interested in helping us take out the best parts of the different podcasts. So if you listen to these podcasts and you think, wow, yeah, I could highlight a few, like from minute 42 to minute 55. That was a great clip. We're looking for you. Like, we just want to know what the best parts of the podcast were so that we can make little compilation clips, and people who do not have an hour to listen to us ramble on, they can get the Cliff Notes version. So if you're interested in that, please reach out to myself or Vishnu and let us know that you want to help out. That's all we got. Now let's get into the show.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of MLOps Community Coffee Sessions. I'm Vishnu, and I'm joined here, as usual, by Demetrios. How you doing, man?
What's going on, everybody? I'm stoked to talk to Jesse today. This is going to be interesting for everyone that is in the biotech sphere. But even if you're not, I think we got some gems ready and waiting for you all.
That's exactly right. We're very excited to have here Jesse Johnson, the VP of Data Science and Engineering at DuPoint Therapeutics. I'm going to let Jesse introduce himself, but I just want to say I'm very excited to have you on here, Jesse, today, and have our listeners hear from you, because you are, and your career is, the epitome of this exciting wave of tech meets biotech. I'm very interested in it. Many people are very interested in it, especially given how pertinent this has become with the pandemic and mRNA and all that's been going on in this world. I want to thank you for joining us, and please tell us about yourself.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me on. Like you said, I'm at DuPont Therapeutics, where I'm in charge of the data engineering and data science teams. Before that, I actually started off as an academic mathematician studying a field called topology, got into data science and machine learning through what's called topological data analysis, and then ended up kind of realizing that, you know, a lot of the problems aren't on the ML side, really on the data engineering side. And then that kind of led me, you know, into kind of the realm that I'm in today. And then also, you know, being in the Boston area, it was very natural to get into life sciences and you know, eventually into biotech.
Awesome. And you've had experiences at Verily, Sanofi, Celerity, a number of the most interesting biotech environments, for sure.
Yeah. It's an exciting place to be. And, you know, there's a lot going on there, a lot of really great opportunities. And it's really been nice. You know, when I was sort of left academia, it got into the more kind of mundane, you know, software engineering. It's really nice to be back into a field where I can think about interesting science and research and, you know, kind of gets that good, you know, from kind of day-to-day perspective. It's a nice balance of very, you know, motivated, you know, clearly scoped work, but also with, you know, some interesting science and research.
Can you give us a little bit of a heads up or can you give us a little bit of background on what you were doing at these other companies?
Sure. At Google, I was a software engineer. That was kind of my first experience, my first time in the private sector. And there it was, you know, fairly standard kind of, you know, moving data around, dealing with databases. I transferred to Verily Life Sciences, so that's an Alphabet company based on, you know, focusing on healthcare, a lot of ML for healthcare data, as a way of kind of moving into, you know, life science, healthcare. Again, you know, it was being in Boston, that was a very, very natural move. And so there we were working on a lot of electronic health records, which are the, you know, data that's acquired from hospitals or from insurance companies based on, you know, patients in the healthcare system, and then trying to make predictions based on that, which it turns out is very, very complicated. The data there is a huge, huge mess. And then from there, kind of pivoted into more drug discovery, moving to Sanofi, which is a very large drug discovery or pharma company, and then decided that kind of the big company style wasn't exactly what I was looking for, and had an opportunity to join Celerity, which is a small biotech. When I joined, I think it was around 80 people. And then, you know, grew into the low single digit or low 100s. So they're using data, well, primarily focused on what's called single cell RNA-seq data. So basically, it's a way of, so, you know, individual cells have, you know, DNA gets turned into RNA, and which gets turned into proteins. And you can actually measure how much RNA there is for each gene inside individual cells. And use that to kind of model what's going on in, you know, larger tissues, things like that. So that was kind of the one of the sources of data. There's, you know, a number of others. And then most recently moved into DuPont, which is looking at cells biology from the perspective of what are called biomolecular condensates. So here the idea is that it turns out that cells form these little bubbles of phase-separated liquid or gel or solid that kind of sucks particular molecules into those little bubbles, and then they can use that either to concentrate a reaction or to, you know, sequester molecules so that they don't interact with other molecules. And it's a way that cells can kind of regulate the behavior a lot faster or on a lot shorter time scale compared to, you know, having to go from DNA to RNA to protein.
I just want to say to all our listeners out there that you guys are about to go way back to your high school biology, college biology classes during this podcast.
Right. Well, we may not go, that may be as deep as we go.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. But still, it's still definitely a throwback, and fascinating the number of environments that you've been in where you have health records, you have RNA, and now you're in this sort of, like, you know, middle regime of condensates. I want to start kind of by going back to how you got into software engineering. Many of the people in our community are, you know, masters or PhDs and have experiences coming out of academia, realize that machine learning is something that they want to be a part of, and try to make the transition. Can you tell us about where you were at when you decided to make that jump from being academic to industry practitioner of software engineering?
Yeah, so I was actually much farther along the academic track than I think a lot of people are when they make that transition. So I was actually a number of years into a tenure track job in the math department at Oklahoma State University. And, you know, I kind of, it was a mixture of, you know, not like the geography wasn't exactly my ideal place to be. And, you know, I had started working on topological data analysis as a research subject and was, you know, running into the fact that, like, being very far away from the coasts where a lot of people working on machine learning in general, but, you know, that topic in particular, where it was kind of hard to really figure out what the right problems to work on were. And I, you know, felt like even though I was technically working in applied math, it felt very abstract because I didn't really, you know, have problems to apply it to. And so, you know, that and the general frustrations that, you know, I think a lot of people in academia have with, you know, various things that, well, that could be a whole nother episode to go into that. But basically, I started, you know, looking around, maybe industry is a good option, which if you're in pure math, that's not like an obvious direction. So it you know, took a little longer to kind of figure that out. But eventually, I mean, I was looking into, you know, data science positions, machine learning positions. And then at some point, someone who I knew from undergrad, you know, he was in the Boston area, which is where I wanted to be. And I contacted him and said, hey, he was working at Google, which I hadn't really thought about because at the time they were very software engineering heavy and didn't have, you know, as many data science positions. This was in, I mean, probably 2012, 2013 when I started, you know, working on this. So I reached out to him and said, hey, do you know any good data science positions or, you know, companies in Boston? He said, no, don't bother. Just apply to Google. And so I did. And that turned out to be a really good option as a way of kind of getting like basically a very quick crash course in how to be a software engineer as someone who, you know, knew how to code and wrote terrible code. You know, that I very quickly got knocked out of that, those habits.
Yeah, actually, that is something I want to ask a little bit about, which is, you know, that transition into like your primary output being maybe insights or research into writing code. How prepared were you when you made that jump to Google, which I'm sure many listeners are like, okay, all right, he started with Google, he must have been really good. Can you tell us about what your level of proficiency were and what some of the lessons you got in terms of code and technical systems at Google?
Yeah, so certainly I thought I was much more prepared than I actually was. You know, so I could code well enough to pass a Google coding interview, which is very much, I mean, I think Google, especially, you know, where it is today, it can afford to kind of invest in people and bring in people based on potential rather than based on, you know, the ability to hit the ground running. And that was kind of one of the reasons that I think I didn't end up starting at a startup, because that would have been a disaster, because, you know, it certainly took me months at Google to get to where, you know, at least to where I was being productive. Which is great to have that opportunity. And of course, like the Google interview process for anyone who's interviewed there, it's like, it's very stochastic, right? It's like there's a lot of false positive, or I guess they reject people who would make great employees all the time. And that's like well understood. So I definitely, there was some luck involved in me, you know, getting the right interviewers or whatever it was. So I think the main thing there that I had to learn very quickly was kind of how to set up a project in a way that would succeed, right? A lot of especially coding projects, and I think this is probably true in MLOps as well, there's this little nugget in the center of really interesting kind of the core of what that project is. And it's natural to sort of say, okay, like that, you know, often that may be like the model, right? That or some, you know, some little piece of interesting algorithm, and you write that first. And then you're like, okay, now I have to write everything else. And you start, you know, kind of building out from there. And as you get closer to the things that it actually has to connect up to, you realize that, oh, actually, like there was a bunch of things wrong, right? Maybe it wasn't even the right thing to write in the first place. And so it kind of, and this probably took me longer than it should have to figure out. But one really hard lesson that I had to learn was that you really want to start at the boring stuff on the outside and kind of work your way in and say, okay, like who's, you know, what do the inputs look like? What are the outputs going to look like? And then, you know, and kind of how do we, and then build from there to the kind of the interesting work that actually does that translation.
Can you give us a, like an actual hands-on use case of what you're talking about? Because I find that fascinating. What you're saying is that start from the boring stuff and then work in to that really exciting stuff. What does that look like in practice?
Yeah. So like, let me give you an example from the healthcare space. So let's say you have, you want to predict a class of patients and you want to predict who's going to have a particular long-term illness in say 6 months, right? So diabetes is a good example of this. Is something that, I was sort of involved in a little bit at Verily, so it's kind of my default one, right? It's something that gradually, at some point people get diagnosed with diabetes and they typically have it for the rest of their life. Or in some cases, if it's, kind of pre-diabetes, you can eliminate it. But so you might say, okay, great. If we know someone is going to be diagnosed with diabetes in 6 months, we can actually intervene now and say, okay, you should like fix your diet, start exercising more, and maybe you can avoid that. This is type 2. Type 1 people are typically born with, right? And so you say, okay, great. So we just need to figure out based on everyone's medical history, figure out how to define features, create the predictive model, and then we're good, right? And so then as you start building it, you build your model. It has high accuracy, great. And then you go to implement it. And now there's some issues on both the inputs and the outputs, right? So the outputs is, well, who's using this model, right? Like, are doctors basically looking at their whole patient roster? And then one day one patient flags is like, oh, suddenly they crossed the threshold. This patient in 6 months, you should intervene, right? Well, doctors don't really do that, right? They tend to think about patients when they're in the room with them or, right before they go into the room. So there isn't necessarily that infrastructure in place to like show them these predictions. And of course, in practice, like those predictions aren't going to change fast enough for there to be like a daily dashboard, right? The predictions will only change when the data changes, which will be after the visit, right? So the patient comes in, the doctor talks to them. A day later, the data filters through the system and suddenly they have this score. Now, like, it's kind of like, well, it would have been nice to know that 48 hours earlier instead of, so that's one issue. The other issue on the input side is the data itself, right? So like, how do you tell if someone has diabetes, right? How do you define your source of truth labels? Well, it turns out there's at least three, probably five or six ways you could do that, right? Because there's all these different types of data. The data is not structured in a way to actually be able to predict that well. It's trying to do other things like figure out billing and, get medications in the right place. And so even deciding the source of truth, let alone, so figuring out the source of truth is really hard, which of course means that your predictions are going to be even less accurate since the source of truth isn't actually accurate. And then the other thing is that typically by the time someone is diagnosed with diabetes, they probably already had it for 6 months, right? Because they're suffering from the symptoms and maybe that triggers them to go into the doctor and then maybe the doctor actually figures it out on that visit, right? So there's all these reasons why this beautiful, perfectly accurate model that you built is not actually going to be useful, right? And so if you start with building the model, you're probably going to waste a lot of time.
It's actually, I'm glad that we brought this concept up because it Jesse wrote a beautiful blog post on this concept called Writing Software from the Outside In that I actually refer back to quite often. And, I think something like in machine learning now, what we're starting to do as we move towards this idea of production machine learning and MLOps is like, okay, start with what the API looks like, right? Like, what does your fast API definition look like? And that is an example on the ML side or on the what's in vogue now of how this concept manifests. And I encourage everyone to check out Jesse's blog, scalingbiotech.com. I read it. It's really great. And we're going to be talking a lot about some of the blog posts that he's written on that website. Now, I want to ask one more question on your career trajectory. We've gone from you were an academic that made the transition to software engineering. We talked about some of the lessons you picked up at Google. After you became an effective individual contributor in the software world, how did you then become a software engineering leader at the intersection of data science and software engineering? That's a big jump. Can you tell us about what experiences led you to the place that you are today?
I can, but past results are no guarantee of future, right? Like, I think this is going to be different for everyone. I probably did some things that were kind of, you know, rash and probably not the best choice at the time, but somehow luckily managed to work out. You know, there's probably some like amount of privilege involved in you know, kind of being able to have the opportunities that I did. So again, I'm not suggesting anyone necessarily try this, but I mean, I think basically it was sort of looking for opportunities and, you know, taking them when they came up. So when, you know, I was started off at Google and was kind of having a lot of conversations about different teams that were, doing more data science, machine learning work. Turns out pretty much everyone else at Google was also having those conversations. So it was at a time when, you know, there were starting to be one or two opportunities to work on ML, and basically everyone at the company wanted to do that. So again, I got kind of very lucky and happened to have one with a team that was just starting up. So Verily was kind of spun up in California. I was in the Boston office of Google. And so it happened that they were kind of building out. They were going to start a very small team in Boston and so, or in Cambridge. And so I happened to, you know, have a conversation at that time and was able to convince that team to hire me. It was originally Google Genomics that got kind of transferred into Verily. And then I was the first person to join who wasn't part of that transfer. So again, a lot of luck, a lot of sort of, kind of seizing the opportunity when it came up. And then one of my colleagues there moved to Sanofi, where they were spinning up a new data science and engineering team. And so I kind of followed him there, and then followed his boss from Sanofi to Celerity. And then at some point, I mean, at that point, I was kind of doing the job that you know, I really liked and was going well, and then got a call from a recruiter from DuPont to, you know, that, you know, I thought may as well, you know, you don't say no until you have to. So kind of started that conversation, decided that was actually a really good move. So it was all, I think one thing that I learned throughout this process is that often these things take time. That is, you sort of, at some point you realize, oh, you know, I don't necessarily like what I'm working on. I really like working on this other thing. And you really want to, like, you know, next day to be able to just be working on this new other thing. But often, you know, if you kind of start looking for opportunities, kind of having conversations, like mentioning to your boss, like, oh, there's this other thing that would be great. Often, you know, those opportunities will start showing up. And if, you know, you have to be patient, you know, so often, like with any of these transitions, it was sort of, I decided I wanted to make that transition very far in advance of when it actually happened, you know. And this is true kind of on the large scale switching jobs, but also on the smaller scale, you know, if you just want to tweak what you're working on a little bit, it takes time, but, you know, you just have to keep an eye out for those opportunities.
That is an insight worth its weight in gold. And for a lot of our listeners, I know for me, one of my favorite parts of talking to our guests is understanding how their career got them to where they are. Because we talk to very impressive people, and your lesson right there is really important, which is that it takes time, it takes patience, and these are highly nonlinear and somewhat random trajectories that, you know, events just happen sometimes. Though certainly your skill must have taken you quite far. So I kind of want to transition a little bit and go deeper into some concepts around data engineering, which you really write well about on your blog. Some of the blog posts that I enjoyed were about the operational versus analytical data cycle, talking about the Chimera data platform, writing software from the inside out. All of these, by the way, to our listeners, these are blog posts, the titles of blog posts on Jesse's website. Check them out. I like your descriptions of the fundamental concepts of data engineering. And I was wondering, can you explain your perspective on where we're at with the state of the art in data engineering and what you think some of the outstanding challenges still are?
Sure. So I think, one kind of process model that I've noticed for a lot of these things is often, for whatever reason, a certain idea, its time will come, you know, when like that's the right thing to do. And of course, there won't be a product around that idea yet, because of course there was no point in building a product earlier. And so a lot of teams, like internal teams at, you know, at biotech companies or wherever, will say, oh, there isn't a product available, I'm going to build this. And they'll start building it, right? And so you've seen this with like data catalogs and data lakes. And, you know, now a lot of these, like, there's a lot of ML frameworks that are doing this, where you basically have dozens of teams all building the same thing at the same time because it's not available. And then, you know, and then you get at some point someone will like open source it, or someone will start building the product, and everyone will say, oh, we could buy this now and, you know, free up our engineers. But it's new. It's, you know, it's still got a bunch of rough edges. Our product is more advanced because we started working on it 6 months earlier. So let's not buy it yet. Right. And you kind of keep on. And then at some point you kind of finally get to a mature enough product available that like new teams will start adopting that instead of building their own, but you still have a bunch of these legacy systems. And then, so you often get into these sort of situations where you have this legacy system doing a certain thing and you have now a commercially available option, but you know, the question is always like, when do you transition? So often people talk about like the build versus buy. And I think we're at, with like MLOps, I think we're early in the cycle for a lot of those things. And for data engineering, I think we're kind of a little farther in there, right? In the sense that there's now commercially available data catalog and, you know, data lake solutions out there. Though I think there's still, you know, I think there's still probably a lot of room for improvement there. But yeah, so for MLOps, you know, I see a lot of companies that are just starting, you know, maybe in the last year or two, kind of building these products, where again a lot of companies are still going to have their internal version of it, you know, Jupyter Notebooks are a great example, right? A lot of people are still, you know, spinning up their own EC2s and just you know, installing Jupyter on there. But then you also are starting to have products like kind of managed notebooks so I think MLOps is very early on in that process, whereas data engineering I think is a little more, you know, deeper into it, though still not at a point where there's a lot of, you know, really well-established, you know, kind of canonical options.
That notion of canonical is key, and I want to dive deeper into that and how you have put that into practice at Dewpoint. So can you tell us a little bit about what some of the data challenges and machine learning challenges you're solving are at Dewpoint, and to the extent possible, what your tooling around data and machine learning look like?
Sure. So our tooling around machine learning. So there, for notebooks, we're using, I always blank on the name from, so AWS's kind of ML.
SageMaker,
yes. So we're using SageMaker notebooks. You know, we've got a Kubernetes cluster with, you know, mostly TensorFlow models. So there, you know, I think we're probably doing more custom engineering than we need to. I think we haven't yet, you know, kind of found that sort of one product that's going to just take away all of the, you know, or at least, you know, 90% of the ops there. So that's on kind of the ML side of things. There's also a lot of more we do a lot of image processing, and so there are non-ML based you know, methods for a lot of this. So there's sort of commercial image segmentation and analysis software that we're using. There's also a number of open source options like Cell Profiler. There, one of the issues we were running into is that the commercial version is very easy to use because it's tied to the microscopes. And so the scientists are all used to using that because that's, you know, that's really easy for them to use. I'd love for them to use something open source like Cell Profiler, you know, but of course, like there's some, you know, to make that transition, it's not a matter of just, you know, fixing the technical result. It's also there's this kind of change management involved there in, you know, convincing folks who are used to one piece of software to switch to another one. So it's still, and again, I'm, you know, so I kind of, we're still very early in kind of figuring out all of these things.
Got it. And can you tell us a little bit about the team structure that you're supporting and what that looks like at Dewpoint?
Sure. So on the, so we have, let's see. So on the data side, we have a deep learning, machine learning team. So doing a lot of the kind of development of neural networks. So that's kind of more exploratory work, kind of building these tools for doing a lot of this image analysis. And then we have a data science team, which is still fairly small, that we're in the process of building up, and that I see as kind of more of a glue function. So that is, they should be the ones who are working very closely with you know, the folks on the other side of the, you know, on the wet lab side of things, you know, understanding what the needs are, communicating those back, potentially building new tools for that, but really doing a lot of the, really their main function is meant to be sort of the glue and the communication between the wet lab and the digital side of things. And then we also have a data engineering team, which we're in the process of building up. It's hard to find good data engineers these days, but you know, we're slowly building that.
So talk to me about this idea of you being the VP of data science and data engineering and how that has created, I imagine there's a lot of decisions that have happened because of that and because of taking more of a holistic view on data. And what does that look like? And what are some things that have happened because of that?
Yeah. So, right. So I think one thing, one thing that I've noticed throughout, like when it comes to these kind of decision-making is that I think we often take for granted the mental models that different people bring with them to these discussions. And so, you know, we all kind of know, well, we know what a model is, right? And what a mental model is kind of the same, the sort of inside your own head, that way of the kind of simple, the way you decide to simplify the world into a, you know, into a form where you can use it to make predictions and understand why things happen. And so the mental models that you bring with you into a job are going to depend on your background and, you know, what you were doing before, what you've seen, what models have been most effective to help you do your job previously. And so in any organization, you have people from different backgrounds who are kind of coming together and therefore bringing their own mental models. In biotech, I think you have very, you know, especially in modern biotech where you also have a data group, you know, you've got all the different mental models that you'd have in the lab between biologists and chemists and doctors and, you know, or clinicians. And then you also have all the data folks, you know, data scientists, data engineers, ML engineers. And so the problem that you often have when it comes to decision making is that they all have a different understanding of sort of what's the situation, what are you trying to solve for, what's an acceptable solution, what tools are available. And so, you know, I found that it's good to be very conscious of this and also very deliberate in kind of how you make those decisions. And so thinking about kind of how communication flows, having people, you know, who's spending time together, because spending time together is going to increase the chances that you'll align those mental models. And so for example, in this case, the you know, the data engineers, I think that's a very the problems that they're solving are very technical and are very distant from what the biologists are interested in you know, solving for. And so if they try to communicate with each other, there's kind of a big gap there, right? Whereas having the data scientist as someone who kind of lives a little bit on both sides and is able to bridge that gap and can translate those, you know, the problems that come out or the problems that result from, you know, lab processes, translate those into what the data engineers need to do, you know, is one way to solve that. But then also you kind of need to make sure that the data scientists are spending time enough, you know, with the folks so they can build those shared mental models.
One of the things I find most interesting about biotech is that it is going through a period of rapid ramp up in the scale and quantity and type of data that's being collected. Mm-hmm. So in other industries, you know, maybe in the 90s, finance, retail, they all digitized and they kind of figured out these are our broad data types, mm-hmm. you know, transactional data and member data, you know, whatever else. I think biotech is going through that now. Is that correct? And what kinds of new data are coming online that are making it maybe harder to design a data platform?
Yeah, so I think it's more complicated than that, because in some ways, biotech has always had, you know, large volumes of data that, you know, that it's used, right? I mean, the genomics goes back decades, right? Like the beginning of the Human Genome Project, like those sources of data have been around for a long time. So I think it's an oversimplification to say that this is new in biotech. I think there's been a lot of changes in the nature of that data in the last few years, and I think a lot more interest in it. And I think it's gotten to a point now where I think it's for whatever reason, there's a lot more folks on the tech side who are kind of starting to notice that and getting involved in it. And so the nature of it is changing from, I think, earlier on, there was more of a kind of IT model of, you know, you sort of, you know, that kind of follows more of a traditional kind of corporate IT role. I could be wrong about that. Of course, I'm relatively new to it as well. Whereas now I think it's more of a kind of people coming in with a mindset of like kind of a tech startup, right? And indeed, you have a number of folks who are building, you know, coming from the tech sector, building their own biotech startups that where they're bringing in, you know, again, those, it's so the mental models that the company is based around are, you know, closer, more aligned with kind of the tech side than with the biology side. So it's not so much the technical aspects of the data. I think it's more the approach and the mix of kind of people and the mindsets that they bring into it.
So you're saying basically it's not that there's new forms of data, it's that the way data is viewed has changed.
Yes. I mean, and certainly there are new forms of data. And I think the scale, you know, is constantly increasing, but it's not, I think it would be, yeah, I would say it's not completely new to biotech, but I think there is a shift happening.
That makes sense. And so one of the questions that I have from that is just, I think a lot of our listeners, while they may be familiar with some aspects of biotech, especially given how, again, in vogue it is now with all the vaccines, aren't necessarily familiar with the particulars of how many different kinds of data that can be incorporated into experiments and used to pick candidates. Can you give us, you know, in whatever way is familiar to you, maybe a little bit of a layman's understanding of experiment data output?
Sure. Yeah. And I think, so I don't know if it's worth going into kind of specific data sources. And of course, there's the ones that I'm familiar with, and there's a lot more that, you know, I haven't had the opportunity to touch on. Sure. I will say, in general, one of the key kind of features, patterns here, is that there's the data and there's the metadata. And I think those are things that are kind of always come in parallel, but are often disconnected. And I think people often forget about the metadata, particularly if you're coming in from a more, you know, from a tech background. And actually even on the biology side for other reasons. But basically, so you'll have some instrument that is generating data, right? So you prepare a sample, you insert it into the instrument, and then the instrument makes a bunch of calculations and then outputs, you know, some files that have all that data. So now what a biologist would typically do if they were kind of doing this independently is they'd have an Excel sheet where they keep track of what, you know, what they put into the different different samples that went into the machine. Then the data comes out, they'll look at it, and, you know, they'll kind of cross compare to know, like, okay, how did I prepare each sample? You know, how long did I leave it in for? What compounds did I put into it? Whatever those are. And so for them, they're looking at a few samples at a time. And so it kind of makes sense to do this, you know, looking at an Excel sheet and just kind of cross comparing. And then at the end of the day, after they've done their analysis, they'll, you know, kind of put that into a PDF, maybe leave it in an Excel file, and then drop it into what's called the electronic lab notebook, which is basically, it's just like the lab notebook was where you would record everything that happened. There's sort of legal reasons why you need to have a lab notebook, which is if someone else discovers the same thing as you, you need to have the record. So it's kind of very much focused on solving the problem of, you know, how are we later able to prove that this is, you know, and verify that this is what came out. So now if you have a data scientist coming in and saying, okay, great, you've collected a dozen samples, you know, your colleague collected another dozen samples, this other team had a dozen, it would be great if we could cross compare them all. And you say, okay, well, we've got these Excel files, except that they all have slightly different column names. Some of them are capitalized. Some of them use a synonym, right? The data is fine. The data is all, you know, is because the instrument always exports the data in the same way. You know, we've got all those files sitting on a hard drive somewhere. Maybe it's like on-prem and not in an S3 bucket, but like we can fix that. But the metadata is the key part, right? And I think, and again, this is where you get into these sort of these shared mental models, right? Whereas the biologist says, well, like, why do I need to use the same Excel format as someone else? Like, I'm not going to look at their data. They're not going to look at mine. And even if we do, we can tell, like, I know that, you know, that just because the C is, you know, capital instead of lowercase, it's the same thing, right? Whereas the data scientist comes and says, okay, it's going to take me hours to fix this. Like, clearly that's a problem. That's a big problem, right? So you have a very, you know, there's kind of that disconnect there. But then also the data scientist may be saying, well, but we've got the data, like maybe the Excel sheets don't even matter. And then, of course, once you dive in, you realize that they do. So I think for me, like the data is it's not a solved problem, but it's kind of there are solutions there, right? We've gone through the whole big data kind of era. There are ways, like, it doesn't matter if it's gigabytes or terabytes of data that's coming off of the instruments, that's fine. The much harder part is the metadata, and that's an organizational and operational kind of problem. You know, just get three different scientists to agree on what the column headers should be. You know, I dare you.
I totally see what you're saying, and it's fascinating to hear you put it in the context of an actual lab process, which is not something that, you know, we know as much about, but the general problem you're describing of how to structure real world context into interpretable data fields, I feel that is something that I can really relate to in my sort of more traditional healthcare experience, where in our case, we have a sort of conflict in my setting between how clinicians might structure data about a patient, whereas insurance might structure the same information in a very different way. And getting those fields to align, well, you know, good luck.
Yep.
I'm curious, in your environment now at DuPont, where you are having the opportunity perhaps to build some of this from the ground up, how are you trying to solve that challenge? Is it through more conversation? Are you trying to use tooling? Is there other experiences that, or other companies whose lessons have inspired you? I'm curious how you're trying to solve it.
Yeah, so I think on the technical side, I think it's once you kind of understand what the solution is, you know, that's fairly straightforward. So of course, you know, we try to hire great data scientists, data engineers, but really, I think where it requires more kind of thoughtfulness, more where it's a little more challenging, is on the organizational side again. And this is where this notion of shared mental models comes in, because if you can, I guess my hypothesis is that once you kind of recognize that this is something to be solved for, and that this is where some of these challenges come from, it kind of changes it gives you a lens to view these issues through, right? And you can sort of start asking, okay, like, is this breakdown in communication? Is it because, you know, a clash of mental models, or is it something more more practical? Though often, you know, it's kind of a little bit of both. And so like one thing that we've done for, you know, for collecting better metadata is creating kind of deliberately, explicitly creating cross-functional teams, where you sort of say, the 10 of us are now, like, we're all going to talk about how we solve this problem of, you know, what should the spreadsheets look like. And often that may not mean we're all reviewing spreadsheets together, but it may be that the 10 of us agree that these two or three people are going to come up with a proposal, and then we're all going to review it. Because what happens, especially with the metadata, and actually I wrote on, so in my newsletter and on my blog, which is also scalingbiotechsubstack.com. Basically what happens is that everyone in the lab, right, even if they recognize that it's a problem that these Excel files are kind of inconsistent, they don't feel like they, as an individual, can like tell everyone else what to do, right? And the data scientists, you know, they're getting, you know, these mismatched column names and all of that, and they don't feel like they can tell the biologist what to do, right? And so usually they just kind of grumble about it, fix the data, and move on, right? And then the biologists continue using their, you know, whatever conventions they want. And so sometimes you have to kind of deliberately tell people, okay, we all recognize this is a problem. No one of us feels like we can solve it. So you know, you point to one person and you say, you're now going to solve this. And now, of course, as like a VP, it's much easier for me to do that. I think, you know, if you're coming in, if you're kind of trying to lead upwards, you know, or manage upwards, right, like, you're going to have to do this differently. But I think still, like, getting people into the room and saying, we now have everyone who, you know, every stakeholder is now in this room. Let's agree, you know, one person is going to give us a solution. Anyway, so that's one thing where, again, you know, I think, sort of, it helps aligning the mental models by kind of talking about, like, what the problem is and what's our approach to the solution, getting everyone on board with what's the process we're going to follow.
Yeah, that knowledge sharing is key. And I really appreciate the way that you look at, there's not just the data, but then there's the metadata that goes in parallel, and how important both of them are. Like, it's two halves to the whole, in a way. So I want to jump back to something you said a few minutes ago. And so it's going to be like we're retracing our steps a little bit. But I thought about this idea when you were talking about the maturity between what we're seeing in data engineering at the moment and the maturity that we're seeing in the ML ops space or the ML tooling space, and how right now it feels like the data engineering is more mature and we're starting to see these companies coming out because they've been building this at wherever their last company was. And then they said, you know what, let's just open source this, or let's make a product out of this and bring it to market. And so with ML, we're obviously seeing a lot of that happening. With data engineering, we've been seeing that happening for longer. I wonder about the way that things are happening in the space, and if you feel the idea of having a managed service when it comes to data, is that something that people are inherently against, or they kind of irk at because of all of the security and just the privacy issues that go around that? And so do you feel like that makes it harder to bring something to market?
So I think it varies a lot. And I think a lot of it has to do with sort of the, you know, the background of the person that you're talking to, and really even to some extent when they kind of came into the field. You know, certainly like at the, like in the, you know, five, 10 years ago, when, you know, when the cloud was just becoming a thing, that was a huge problem. Where, you know, this idea of like having your data hosted on a server that's not physically in your building, right? Whereas now I think it's much more common for people to say, oh yeah, as long as it's in our own S3 bucket, if it's, you know, in our own AWS account or you know, whatever cloud provider you use, as long as it's in our, like, something that we manage, like, that's fine, right? But I think you're also, you know, there's a lot of folks who would say, well, okay, as long as you're, you know, following security best practices, like, for me, if you came to me with a managed service and said, like, you know, we're ISO whatever compliant, you know, we'll store your data for you, I would probably say, okay, so I assume that you're gonna be more secure storing it than I am, right? Because you've probably invested a lot more in those, you know, our security is awesome, but, you know, like, I assume that, like, if you're doing this professionally, you know, that you've covered all those bases. I'm sort of relatively new to the field, so I came in at a time when, you know, cloud was standard, right? So I think it varies a lot. I think in general, you know, folks who are more used to kind of the cloud approach are going to be fine with that. And then some of the, there's probably still a few holdouts who are going to be very nervous about that.
So to kind of put a bow on this entire conversation, I want to ask you about something that you wrote, I think, in your most recent blog post about what you want to write about in 2022. And that's this idea, and I'm going to quote, you said, "My role has really become one of pushing the organization to change in ways that would allow it to use data more effectively." Mm-hmm. I think that's a great summary. And I want to ask you, what are some of the ways in 2022 that you're planning to achieve that mission?
Right. So a lot of those, again, revolve around this lens of shared mental models. So it's ways of kind of creating the conversations that allow the folks on the wet lab side to really understand sort of what's needed, like what good data looks like, you know, how we can kind of produce more data that flows into the data teams more effectively. So there's kind of, between the wet lab and digital, there's kind of two directions of flow. It's a cycle, right? You've got the data going from the wet lab into the modeling, the data science, machine learning teams, and so shared mental models allow you to do that consistently. And then on the other end, and this is something I guess we didn't really have time to touch on, but understanding how machine learning can accelerate the science. So how do you go from that data back into insights? And this is something I guess I'll just, so science is you know, has a, there's, you know, the scientific method is, you know, it's kind of step by step, you know, very, you know, it's all about causality, things like, you know, it's sort of, you kind of want to understand every step. Machine learning, as we all know, tends to be more effective if you can, you know, have a lot of data, create a black box model, you know, you can get more accurate results. But that doesn't exactly align up with the science. So on the other direction, there's kind of understanding how do we kind of, you know, match those up and find the right types of problems to solve on the data side that are going to accelerate the science, and do it in a way where it kind of feeds back and accelerates the scientific method rather than trying to replace it. So again, setting up the structures that allow people to have those conversations and, you know, come up with ideas that they wouldn't have thought up on their own.
Collaboration to improve the scientific method. Sounds like what 2022 is going to look like for you.
Yes.
So awesome, man.
And so with that, I want to thank you, Jesse, for joining us, for sharing your knowledge and giving our listeners and me and Demetrios a peek into what's happening in the world of biotech, which we don't touch that often. I think it's so cool. I think we all think it is. And it's been really, really a pleasure to have you and learn from you. And I encourage everyone out there, sign up for Jesse's Substack blog. Check it out. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun. Yeah,
I really appreciate it, Jesse. Yeah, I learned a ton. I was just like a fly on the wall here. And I think that you call out a few things that are very obvious after you say them, but I never was able to eloquently put them that way. So I appreciate you saying it, because now I'm going to probably steal a few of these quotes, hopefully you don't mind, and bring them into other conversations that we have. So thanks again, man. This was awesome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.